The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 5th, 2022. On this week's crossover episode, we bring you an episode of Live from Ukraine, in which Oleksandra Povorovchnik talks about language, politics, and wartime culture. Povorovchnik is a Kyiv-based journalist, film critic, and translator, who joined me live on Twitter Spaces to discuss the changing politics of language in Ukraine, as well as the country's defiant sense of humor and wartime culture. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 5th, live from Ukraine. This is Live from Ukraine, a conversation with Ukrainian voices taped live on Twitter Spaces. To join future audiences, follow me at Benjamin Wittes. I want to start, as I do with all of the, your Twitter bio has an interesting account of yourself, which is kind of whimsical. I used to be a film critic at vertigo.com.ua and a translator of food-related stuff. Then Russia invaded my homeland. So give us the longer extended dance version of that. Who were you before the full-scale invasion?
Well, I studied sociology for my bachelor's degree. Then I got a master's degree in journalism, and I decided I wanted to do that. But then, you know, I wrote on a lot of topics, you know, especially topics that have to do with, you know, the society in general or arts and stuff. But then gradually I sort of realized that I love movies. I've always loved movies, and that, you know, not a lot of people in Ukraine write and talk about movies in Ukrainian, you know. I think a lot of people who, you know, have found their sort of niches in the Ukrainian, I don't know, creative world or media world, all of them at a certain point in their lives, they sort of realize that, you know, there's not much, you know, food-related or movie-related or, you know, whatever-related content in Ukrainian made for Ukrainians by Ukrainians. So I sort of, you know, started doing that. I'm still, you know, an editor at, I think, the largest web outlet devoted to writing about movies and TV series and, you know, just visual arts in general in Ukraine, which writes in Ukrainian. Although, obviously, you know, we haven't been as active as we were before the war because, you know, even just seeing a movie in Ukraine right now is very stressful, and you know the cinemas have reopened a little, but it's still not, you know, as big of a part of our life as it used to be before the invasion. And you know, I think as a lot of my peers, we were, you know, at a point in our lives when, you know, our careers were starting, you know, to really take off, and we were thinking, well, you know, 2022 is definitely going to be the year for us. You know, because COVID is almost over and, you know, this is going to be a good year for us professionally and, you know, personally. And then the invasion started and, you know, it seems kind of weird to, you know, write about movies or to use Twitter to, you know, to complain about your, I don't know, personal life or whatever, when, you know, you're seeing the things that Ukrainians are seeing right now. So I started writing about my own experiences, you know, a little bit because I felt like I had to vent. I saw a lot of, you know, really cynical disinformation online, a lot of English-speaking people sort of making fun of the war, and it just, you know, it hurt me. So I started, you know, being more active on social media and writing about that stuff. And I don't know, it's been both a curse and a blessing because, you know, I have been able to get my point across to a lot of, you know, wonderful non-Ukrainians and, you know, and maybe even, you know, support Ukrainians in the way that they see people writing about the things that, you know, they're discussing in their kitchens, but they see, you know, people like me writing about the same things in English and sort of amplifying that to a more general audience. But also, you know, it is stressful. So I think one day I'm definitely going to write some kind of essay about how social media has impacted all of us Ukrainians. And it's definitely going to be a very bleak essay, but someone has to do it, you know, sooner or later. But yeah, that's the longer version, I guess.
Well, when you're ready to write that essay, I would love to have Lawfare publish it. So I want to talk to you about this week. You tweeted just before we went live that you were going to crawl into your basement as soon as we were done, and then that you don't have a basement. On the one hand, Kyiv is relatively normal right now. On the other hand, everybody seems to be expecting major Russian strikes in connection with Ukrainian Independence Day. How do things feel right now?
Well, you know, I have to start by saying that I'm one of the definitely luckier Ukrainians. I think that, you know, so far me and my family have been as lucky as you can be, really, while being Ukrainian and in Ukraine. I'm currently in Hostomel, which is, you know, sadly, a place which is, you know, famous the world over, but, you know, sadly, not for the things that I'd ever wanted to be famous for. And, you know, they were very lucky to get out in time. And, you know, my husband and our kid and I, we also managed to get out of Kyiv quite early. So we've been lucky, and a lot of my friends have been lucky. So I think we're, you know, we obviously, you know, Ukraine has been a very dangerous place to be in for the last 6 months. And you can't really say that a certain city is, you know, is safe because, you know, they're all relatively dangerous. And I think a lot of, you know, my peers and a lot of people who, you know, have returned back to Kyiv from, you know, wherever they were during the past couple of months, I think a lot of them feel, you know, both sort of, you know, on edge, obviously, and scared, but also sort of, you know, defiant in this kind of almost slightly hysterical way, because, you know, when you've seen so many, you know, shopping malls or just residential buildings being randomly, as it seems, destroyed, and then, you know, everyone starts saying that, you know, Russia is going to, you know, is planning something big for the Independence Day, you know, some of us, me included, sort of, you know, laugh in a slightly deranged way and say, well, you know, bring it on. It's not like they were holding back before. So obviously we're both, you know, a little on edge, or very on edge, but also sort of this has become the new normal. So I think nobody's, you know, the weird thing is that, you know, all the people I've spoken to, even the ones who can leave Kyiv and, you know, go out west or, you know, to the quieter cities, I don't think anyone's really planning that. Everyone's like, okay, we'll probably, you know, stay at home today, probably not go out shopping and, you know, stay further away from, you know, the residential quarter. But, you know, if our, you know, destiny is to die from a Russian missile, then okay, I guess so be it, because you can't live in fear forever. And at a certain point, this sort of, you know, it does become the new normal, and you sort of develop a bleakly humoristic approach towards everything that's happening. So yeah, I think we're definitely a little damaged, but that's our coping mechanism. And I think this is the reason why, you know, right now a lot of people in Kyiv are remaining relatively calm and collected.
Yeah, so I'm interested in the sort of set of feelings around this year's Independence Day. On the one hand, it's obviously a point of pride and defiance. It's also the 6-month anniversary of the beginning of the war, or the beginning of the full-scale war. Is the coincidence of those two events create a sort of desire to be particularly defiant on Independence Day this year, or is it? Or is the fact that there is, you know, expected rocketing and missile strikes just, you know, going to tend to keep people at home?
That's a great question. You know, I think a couple of years ago, my husband and I were talking about how, you know, how obviously, you know, we have holidays such as the Independence Day, but, you know, nobody really celebrates them in the way, I guess, you know, some Americans at least celebrate, you know, the 4th of July. So you don't really have, you know, people, you know, holding huge barbecues or whatever. And there's not, you know, a lot of...
Yeah, we take the 4th of July pretty seriously.
Yeah, yeah. So at least, you know, there's no, you know, Independence Day of Ukraine-related merch on sale. And, you know, a couple of years back, my husband and I were talking about it, and we said, well, you know, I wish people would take it, you know, more seriously and, you know, go all out and, you know, well, I think this year we kind of got what we wished for, albeit in an absolutely horrific way, because, you know, Independence Day and National Flag Day was something which was, you know, for me at least, it was something mostly which, you know, we celebrated maybe at school, maybe with, you know, some sort of like 15-minute assembly or whatever, or kids might have been encouraged to wear blue and, you know, and yellow to school. But this year, I have noticed that a lot of people are taking this a lot more seriously. And obviously, you know, for safety reasons, I think not many people will be, you know, celebrating in with large public gatherings or whatever. But I think at home, everybody I know is, you know, going to be defiantly, you know, doing something a tiny bit special. And, you know, obviously these sort of ways of celebrating, they're very different. You know, some people are just planning on wearing their sort of national garb, their vyshavankas. Some are, you know, inviting friends over, especially if they, you know, lucky enough to be in the suburbs or somewhere where you can feel a little more safe. So people are, you know, they are gathering, they are planning to do something, just because, you know, at the beginning of the war, there was a lot of talk about how people felt sort of guilty for, you know, going out to get coffee, if they were in relatively, you know, safer areas of the country. And a lot of people, you know, felt very guilty for doing these sort of normal everyday things, because they said, well, you know, how can I be sitting around, you know, enjoying a cup of coffee while this horrific thing is still happening? And I think a lot of us have managed to sort of, you know, deal with this sort of, you know, irrational guilt, and have instead turned it into this sort of defiance that, you know, Russians definitely don't want us to be happy and, you know, celebrating, and they want us to, you know, cover in fear. And, you know, this sort of the freedom to celebrate our Independence Day, the freedom to, you know, buy a cup of coffee, the freedom to, you know, go get your nails done is also, you know, what our soldiers on the front lines, they are also, you know, fighting so that the civilians can sort of, you know, go on with their lives and, you know, not feel afraid to go out, you know, shopping, as trivial as it sounds. But, you know, unless we do all of those things and unless we celebrate our Independence Day, especially, you know, since we have we've been reminded of how important this is, unless we do all that, I think there is a very real sort of danger of us, you know, a lot of us going completely insane from stress. So I think it's a little it's interesting how I think for a lot of non-Ukrainians who haven't lived under these circumstances, I think a lot of them get a little confused at how people can, you know, celebrate anything while there's a war going on, or how can people, you know, be brave enough to go to shopping malls or, you know, go to the cinema. But the truth is that we, you know, we really don't have a choice. We have to find this sort of war-life balance just, you know, to preserve our sanities and, you know, also to, I guess, preserve the economy, because that's also obviously something that we have to think about. So, yeah.
Yeah, so a related point, one thing that I think a lot of Westerners have a lot of trouble getting their hands around is the apparently joyful Ukrainian sense of humor in the middle of this stuff. And, you know, you see it in the mischievous memes, in the social media presence is constantly sort of fun, even in these horrid situations. And of course, it's tempered by, you know, the fact that there are war crimes going on and cities being destroyed and people being murdered, of course. But there's it's much more wry and humorful than one would expect it to be. And I've spoken to members of my family who are just bewildered by this. You know, how can they be so humorous when their country is being destroyed? And I'm wondering if it's a similar effect to what you're describing now with buying a cup of coffee, simply, or, you know, getting your nails done, just not being willing to let the Russians take that away.
You know, it's not the first time that someone, or namely Russia, to be honest, it's usually Russia, has been trying to, you know, wipe us, you know, from existence. And Ukrainians historically are not, you know, the luckiest nation, I'd say. We've suffered, you know, a lot. Even, you know, my generation, although, you know, we have been a lot luckier than, you know, up until this year. We have been a little luckier than, you know, our grandparents, for example. But, you know, even we had the Revolution of Dignity, and we had, you know, generally just an awful dictator, a tyrannical president who, you know, slaughtered over 100 people in the middle of our capital. And, you know, that, you know, obviously for a lot of people, that was an extremely traumatic event and an extremely traumatic experience. And yet, you know, if, you know, Ukrainians gather over coffee and start talking about, you know, Yanukovych, the president, the ex-president, who did all those things, I think the first thing they'll mention is, you know, all the funny memes about him. Because, you know, despite the fact that this is a guy who, you know, who ordered so many people, you know, just civilians, peaceful protesters, to be slaughtered by snipers, the first thing that Ukrainians remember about him, although, you know, that wasn't long ago, the first thing that Ukrainians remember about him is, you know, these funny videos of a pine tree falling on top of him, you know. So I think that, you know, over our history, throughout our history, we've had a lot of very traumatic experiences. And I think that humor is definitely some sort of coping mechanism here, because otherwise I genuinely don't know how we'd manage to live through all of that, because, you know, the attempted genocide, the famines, the Soviet occupation, things like that. You know, if you look at cultural artifacts from even the most bleak, you know, sort of times in our history, you know, there were also jokes being written there and, you know, humorous songs and things like that. And even, you know, Taras Shevchenko, who's, you know, probably our most iconic poet and man with, you know, a very difficult life because he was born into serfdom. He was essentially a slave. He, you know, he had a very difficult upbringing. He was bought out of slavery. He was, you know, sent, he was imprisoned. He was forbidden from writing poetry in Ukrainian. And yet this guy who, you know, was definitely had a very difficult life, he was also known for being, you know, sort of a prankster and, you know, for drawing erotic portraits and, you know, stuff like that. So I think that, you know, although as someone who's, you know, who studied sociology in university, I've definitely been taught not to talk about, you know, the mentality of a nation or whatever, because that's, you know, that's BS. But, you know, in this case, I have started, you know, thinking that maybe, you know, these things are in our blood, because it's difficult to explain to an outsider, you know, how Ukrainians, you know, react to an invasion of their homeland by, you know, making frankly adorable memes about one of the soldiers who invaded, you know, their country. And, you know, instead of hating him or, you know, saying that he should be dismembered or whatever, Ukrainians on TikTok are, you know, making makeup tutorials to look like him, or, you know, making cutesy videos of, you know, of how they wish he would come to Ukraine as a tourist. And, you know, they're photoshopping him into, you know, like historical landmarks and, you know, and the best hotels of Odessa. So that's, I think, you know, a little, some of it borders on this sort of, you know, hysterical humor of someone going through a, you know, slight sort of nervous breakdown. But it's also one of the, you know, only coping mechanisms that are affordable to us right now.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So I want to ask about the politics of language, which was a feature of the Twitter thread with which we began, but is also a feature of a number of other threads you've written. There is a pervasive misunderstanding in the West about what language means in Ukraine. And I was definitely party to this misunderstanding myself, and really had to unlearn it over a protracted period of time. But we have a kind of way of understanding language as a kind of proxy for ethnicity, despite the fact that, you know, in the United States, we speak English and we don't think of ourselves as therefore connected in some deep political sense to, you know, the rest of the English-speaking world as a consequence. But we do have this sense when, you know, when Russia propagates this idea that, you know, Russian-speaking people in Eastern European countries, or for that matter, in Central Asian countries, are a kind of repressed minority. We do have this instinctive internalization of the idea that there's something that binds Russian-speaking peoples together, and that we should understand Ukraine as divided between Ukrainian-speaking people and Russian-speaking peoples who are somehow represented by the Russian state. That has kind of broken down since February 24th, but your thread particularly interested me because it sort of suggested that people are, you know, really making a political decision that they really want the lingua franca of Ukraine to be Ukrainian. I'm just curious for your thoughts about what it means, what the signifier is now in Ukraine in terms of what language people speak.
To be honest, I thought, you know, as a Ukrainian, that, you know, all of these sort of things and issues with the language, that they'd be, you know, clear as day to me. But I sort of noticed that while I was writing some of my language-related threads on Twitter, I had to sort of rethink some of the things that, you know, I'd gotten used to saying, because I realized that I hadn't really, you know, processed a lot of the reality that surrounds me, and I hadn't really, you know, put it into words before. For example, you know, whenever I start, you know, talking about Russian-speaking Ukrainians and Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians, I recently thought, hey, that doesn't really exist, because whenever we talk about Ukrainian or Russian-speaking Ukrainians, we also have to consider the fact that they're, you know, mostly Russian-speaking Ukrainians, or mostly Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians. Because, you know, for example, my parents, they both speak mostly Ukrainian. You know, we spoke Ukrainian in our family, but, you know, they both have friends that they are used to talking to in Russian, just because, you know, that's the way they're accustomed to, you know, to dealing with them. I am a mostly Ukrainian speaking person, but I also have friends who I've always spoken to in Russian, and, you know, and using Ukrainian with them, it still feels, you know, a little odd. And, you know, at the same time, the people who, you know, who a lot of us would, you know, sort of describe as Russian speaking, they know Ukrainian, because in Ukraine, it's, you know, it's not like the people that are usually described as the Russian speaking minority, whatever that means. It's not like they don't know Ukrainian. That's a myth, because pretty much everybody in Ukraine is bilingual. Because, you know, our classes in school are in Ukrainian. Our, you know, the curriculum is in Ukrainian. To enter university, you have to pass several exams, which are in Ukrainian. You know, the TV is in, you know, everything that surrounds us is pretty much, a lot of it is about, you know, 70% is in Ukrainian. So even the people who prefer to speak Russian and, you know, and read in Russian or write in Russian, they know Ukrainian. And the same goes for, you know, mostly Ukrainian speaking people who might not want to speak Russian for, you know, mostly political reasons, but a lot of them, no, I think the overwhelming majority of them, they might not, you know, be very comfortable speaking Russian, because they might have, you know, have accents, or if they haven't spoken Russian in a long while, then, you know, it might sound a little off. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, all of our grandparents and parents, the majority of the books, the, you know, the literature of all kinds that they have in their homes, the majority of it is in Russian, because in the Soviet Union, you know, most of the books that were printed in Russian. So even if you come from a, you know, a very sort of Ukrainian, proudly Ukrainian speaking family, you still probably know Russian, because, you know, there's just so much content in Russian that, you know, even if you didn't learn it at school, and a lot of people did, then, you know, you still, you know, you've come across all of this content in Russian. And even if you're not comfortable speaking it, you probably know Russian grammar pretty well. So it's not like, you know, the Russian-speaking Ukrainians or Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians or whatever, it's not like, you know, there are people in Ukraine who are unable to buy a loaf of bread in a supermarket because, you know, the sales assistant refuses to, you know, talk to them in Russian or whatever, and they don't know Ukrainian, so they can't get, you know, food or access to, you know, whatever services. Russian propaganda sort of does portray it that way sometimes, but that's definitely not what's happening. The reality is that, you know, a lot of families speak both Ukrainian and Russian, and you'll have situations when, you know, one partner in a relationship prefers to speak Russian, the other might prefer to speak Ukrainian, and, you know, that's exactly what they do. They, you know, they hold conversations in two languages. For example, I have a friend who used to speak mostly Russian before the full-scale invasion. Her parents both speak mainly Russian. Of course, she knows Ukrainian because she learned it at school, and, you know, she usually used to switch to Ukrainian when, you know, the situation demanded it. But after the full-scale invasion, she said that, you know, she didn't feel comfortable using Russian anymore, so she would, you know, switch full-time to Ukrainian. And she only uses Ukrainian now. Her husband, meanwhile, who is, you know, just as patriotic as her, and, you know, just as appalled as her, you know, by all of these monstrosities happening, he still feels comfortable using Russian, and he continues using Russian. And, you know, they're a happy, happy couple using two languages at home, you know. And, you know, they have an infant daughter, and he uses Russian when talking to her. And, you know, his wife, he talks to her in Ukrainian. So I know that, you know, for people who aren't sort of used to living in the sort of bilingual society, it does sound insane. It, you know, also sounds a little insane when I talk about it, because, you know, I'm just now processing the, you know, very odd peculiarities of Ukrainian society. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, most Ukrainians are, I think the overwhelming majority of Ukrainians are, to at least some extent, bilingual. They might not be, you know, as comfortable using one language as they are using the other, but, you know, they definitely understand both.
But the what I thought was so interesting about your the hairdresser thread was this idea that the default language is changing, and that there was a certain assumption in certain places before that you walk into a shop and maybe the default language in that shop is Russian. And now there's a sort of civic decision being made by a lot of people that the default language should be Ukrainian. Do you perceive that as, I sort of took as the importance of the thread that you kind of perceived that default as shifting?
Definitely. You know, as a kid who came from a predominantly Ukrainian-speaking family, I have grandparents who speak Russian, but still, you know, as a kid, my parents used Ukrainian with me, and then I spent some time in the UK. And when I came back and started Ukrainian school, I knew Ukrainian and English. I understood Russian, but I couldn't really, you know, I didn't sound natural using Russian. I did sound a little weird. And I got, you know, teased a lot, not, you know, for speaking in an accent, but, you know, for being mostly Ukrainian speaking, which is, you know, it's very weird because I went to a very sort of prestigious school in Kyiv, which is, you know, it's considered to be a great school. It's named after one of the most prominent Ukrainian poets. But, you know, still, kids would mostly speak Russian. And the kids who, you know, who spoke Ukrainian at home, they would be sort of not teased for it directly, but they would still sort of feel this peer pressure to, you know, whenever their parents would call them on the phone, these kids, myself included, would try to give, you know, very short answers, usually just saying stuff like mm-hmm, and, you know, stuff that wouldn't sort of give away the fact that our parents spoke Ukrainian and that we were actually Ukrainian speaking people at home.
And just to be clear, is that because there is something of a, or historically is something of a class differential in which the sort of language of education was both in late Tsarist times and in under the Soviets was Russian, or is there some other reason for that?
It's definitely that. It does have a lot to do with, you know, these stereotypes that mostly which, you know, sort of obviously, you know, if in Tsarist times, if you wanted to make a career, if you wanted to, you know, to write, to, you know, become successful in life, you had to learn Russian and you had to use Russian. And in the Soviet times, you know, since the sort of Soviet society considered factory workers and mechanics and, you know, these sort of technical professions as more important to the society than, you know, the farmers who were sort of, you know, seen as these rural sort of slightly silly bumpkins who, you know, were in need of being, you know, cultured and taught the, you know, the proper sort of urbanized way of life. There was also, you know, this stereotype that, you know, the people in large cities, they would speak Russian, and the people who spoke Ukrainian, they, you know, they were obviously from, you know, sort of rural areas, and they weren't as smart. And even after the collapse of the Soviet Union, if you see, you know, if you watch any sort of Russian TV show, and, you know, since Russia is objectively a richer country than Ukraine, they created a lot more sort of entertaining content than Ukraine did, especially in the early 2000s. So essentially, they flooded our market with their TV shows and films. And in all of these, you know, film shows and TV shows, there would probably be, you know, this very sophisticated, classy Russian-speaking character, and probably some kind of, you know, vaguely Ukrainian or vaguely Georgian or vaguely, I don't know, Kazakh-sounding sort of bumbling, silly sidekick. I don't know if you know this, but in the early 2000s, Russia actually made, a Russian channel made sort of a reboot or a remake of The Nanny. And in this version, the nanny wasn't from Queens. She was from Mariupol. And she was, you know, pretty much, you know, the nanny. She was very loud and slightly obnoxious. But, you know, this sort of this way of, you know, portraying her, it sort of used a lot more of these stereotypes about Ukrainians. And
so in other words, the Russian sort of pop culture stereotype of Ukrainians and therefore the Ukrainian language is, I mean, to use an American analogy, is kind of a like the way a lot of Northerners will treat a kind of Rube as having a Southern or mountain accent. Is that there's a sort of a regional bigotry that is mapped onto people being uncultured, unsophisticated, etc.
Yeah, definitely. I think in the Soviet times, being Russian was seen as the default. Russians were, the normal Soviet people. Ukrainians or Georgians or people from, other ethnicities, they were, in the best case, they were sort of exoticized as seen as the sort of spicy version of the Soviet person. And, so they were either a little, I think, especially when it comes to Ukrainian women, they were frankly fetishized and still are, sadly. But in order to be taken seriously, you did have to learn Russian and speak Russian very well with preferably a sort of Moscowish sounding accent, because otherwise you would be seen as the bumbling, native quirky sort of national costume. And these stereotypes, they stuck, and they're definitely still here. A couple of months ago, I came across the probably most sort of appalling thing I've ever read in my life. As a lot of Ukrainians joke, knowing Russian is both a curse and a blessing, because you know a lot more than the typical Westerner does about Russians, and at the same time you know more than the typical Westerner does about Russians, which is not great. Yeah, and so this guy, it was a blog post of a guy who was fantasizing about how after the war would be over and Russia would obviously win, he'd get as a spoil of the war, he would get a Ukrainian wife, and she'd be, according to him, she'd be, submissive and stupid, and she'd talk in a funny accent. And I think this is just, it showcases how deep these stereotypes run and how active they are in Russian society. Because, even if you take a lot of Russian fantasy books written by modern authors, and these fantasy books are set in Lord of the Rings inspired lands or whatever, and a lot of them still have sort of exotic farmers, daughter characters who speak in obviously Ukrainian accents and are treated as the comic relief. So it's not something that, was just present in the Soviet society. It's something that, it's still there. And I think one of the other stereotypes that, that Soviet society had, and this stereotype is still very present in Russian and Ukrainian society even now, is that, the idea of coming from a small village or, being a farmer or whatever, it meant that you were definitely a sort of a second-class citizen. And since, Ukraine is, famous for being a huge agricultural country and, the breadbasket of Europe or whatever, this sort of, meant that, Ukrainians were treated as second-grade citizens because, they were just, silly farmers. And, and I think subconsciously, a lot of people, even from my generation, they still sort of internalized and repeated these stereotypes, because whenever we had Ukrainian literature classes, certain classmates of mine would complain about how all Ukrainian writers were born in villages and were just stupid villagers and who would want to read them, even though if we dig back a couple of generations back, I can probably guarantee you that, that the majority of my classmates, as do I, we had relatives who were born in villages because, that's the way Ukraine is. And, you know, there's absolutely nothing bad about that. But, you know, we saw it as something bad, as something to be ashamed of. And so, yeah, as a Ukrainian, as predominantly Ukrainian speaking child, I was ashamed to be using Ukrainian. And, you know, it's weird because even like 5 years ago, a guy started hitting on me in the subway in Kiev. And he spoke Russian, I replied in Ukrainian, and, you know, since I didn't want to give him my number or whatever, he started very aggressively sort of insinuating that I had obviously come from some kind of, you know, small village in Western Ukraine, and now I thought that I was, you know, too good for him. And, you know, so, like, even in Kiev, in the capital of Ukraine, if you...
Right, You don't have to scratch deep before the rural prejudice that is associated with Ukrainianism comes to the surface pretty quickly. So I want to go to audience questions, and for members of the audience, this is a good time, if you have a question, to request to speak. But before we do, I just want to ask you about one contradiction in this Russian attitude. There are many, but, you know, at the same time as they think of Ukrainians as the periphery, as the rural rubes, as the foghorn leghorn of Russian rule, Kiev is, of course, the mythological seat of the original Russian state in their version. And so there's some sense in which they're also looking at Ukraine as the sort of center of authenticity of Russian nationalism in some weird sense. Yeah.
Honestly, there are certain things about the Russian ideology or whatever, which, you know, even to Ukrainians, you know, and we've had a lot of shared history, they are very difficult to understand. And, you know, I think the best way to describe the sort of Russian mentality is a Russian quote, which says that «умом Россию не понять», and means that, you know, you can't understand Russia with your brain, you have to, you know, love it, despite, you know, how contradictory it is. Well, I don't know about loving it, but yeah, there are certain contradictions here. I was certain that, you know, before the invasion, that even if they did invade, they wouldn't bomb Kiev, because, you know, they call it the mother of all Russian cities. So, you know, why would they bomb it? You know, they see it as, you know, part of their own history, their own heritage. And yet, you know, a few weeks back when, you know, it was the day of the baptism of the Kiev Rus, they shot, you know, a lot of missiles at Kiev, you know, on that very morning, you know, despite the fact that they celebrate this day as, you know, the baptism of their own country, as the baptism of Russia. And they agree that it, you know, it happened in Kiev. And yet, for some reason, they still call us, you know, the little brothers. So it's very contradictory. It's very weird. And I genuinely don't know how they wrap their heads around it, because, you know, for me, it's, you know, it's some sort of catch-22 situation.
Yep. All right. We have a pair of questions from Eve Gaumont, who is, I think it's important from the perspective of this first question, is from Quebec. And she asks, Russian-speaking Ukrainians have told me that they are forbidden to speak Russian when they were teaching at universities. Number one, is it true? And number two, could you explain, if it is, the impact of such measures on the protection and promotion of the Ukrainian language in recent years?
Okay, that's actually a fascinating question because, the thing is that, Ukrainians as a society, compared our history to, for example, the history of Ireland and, the way that, the Irish language was, has been replaced essentially by English. And I think a lot of, a lot of politicians and lawmakers are worried that, if we don't protect Ukrainian, then, it'll be in danger of, also disappearing because Russia has, so much money that they can, essentially flood our market with their books, their TV shows, their music, whatever. And, instead of writing or teaching in Ukrainian, it'll be easier to teach or do whatever in Russian. So, our government did adopt a law which aims to protect Ukrainian. Essentially, according to this law, you can use whatever language you like in your daily life. But, certain officials, for example, government officials or university professors, if Ukrainian speaking students ask them to speak or teach or lecture in whatever in Ukrainian, then, that's what they're supposed to do. If, the whole group or the whole classroom is fine with, listening to a lecture in Russian, then if it's okay with everyone, then they can, go ahead and teach in Russian. The reason why they did this is also because, although, I said that a lot of, I think pretty much every Russian speaking Ukrainian knows Ukrainian, some Ukrainians from the Western regions, mostly, they don't really know Russian that well. They might know, Polish instead of Russian or Hungarian. But since those parts of the country were, they joined the Ukrainian Soviet Republic later, Russian isn't as popular and isn't, as mainstream in those regions. So it makes sense, I guess, to, to have lectures in the language which everybody has been learning in school. So I think a lot of effort has been done to, encourage professors in universities to, give lectures in Ukrainian. The problem with that and why, certain professors aren't, too happy about that is because a lot of the, a lot of them don't really know English that well, especially the more old school professors, and they get all of their research from, from Russian sources, and they have old Soviet textbooks in Russian, and they don't really want to make the effort of, coming up with these, this scientific vocabularies in Ukrainian, or, doing research to, because I'm sure, these, all of these.
It's terms, a hard switch.
Yeah. All of these terms exist, but they, don't really feel like, research, especially, as I said, if they're, older people who might have worked in Soviet universities. So I think a lot of them don't really want to do that. But unless they do, then obviously, the Ukrainian scientific community will be just a lesser sort of brother of the Russian scientific community. And, nobody really wants that. So I think that, in a country which has an official language, it is fine to have university professors speak that language and be required to know it, as long as is in their daily life. Nobody goes trying to hunt down Russian speaking Ukrainians, because they're honestly in some parts of the country they're the majority. So I know it was controversial among certain parts of our society, but I think after the invasion, a lot of people, even people who said, why learn Ukrainian? It's not, you know, I prefer speaking Russian. Ukrainian isn't that useful. Anyway, I think even a lot of them have changed their minds, to be honest. And they do want to sort of place some kind of barrier between our society and the Russian one. So yeah.
We are going to need to wrap, but I want to give Belarus the last question. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Benjamin, and for the space. And thank you very much, Alexandra, for your insight. My question, the answer to which is not likely to be brief, but I'm just curious to know, as a Ukrainian, what do you see the future relationship between Ukrainians and Russians evolving into post-war?
Wow, that's a heck of a question to end on. And it's an almost impossible one, as you say, to answer briefly. But Alexandra, your thoughts on it before we wrap?
Okay. Well, I have to say that, you know, a lot, I think, especially, you know, from people who are living through this war, I think a lot of them don't really want to, you know, have anything in common with Russia as soon as, you know, the war is over, even if they have families or friends or ex-friends in Russia. I think a lot of them have been very disappointed by the way that these relatives just, you know, don't believe them whenever they tell them what's happening in Ukraine. And a lot of people thought that, you know, if Putin were to announce an invasion, that, you know, maybe the relatives of Ukrainians would sort of protest and try and keep this at bay, but they didn't. And I think a lot of us are very hurt, very angry by that. So obviously, it has, you know, it has also influenced interpersonal relations, and not just, you know, relations on a state level. I think, you know, personally, I don't really care. Despite everything, I don't wish, you know, for Russia to, I don't know, go up in flames or whatever. I don't really care what their trajectory will be after the war. But I do think that our relations, they do depend on, you know, if the Russian society manages to sort of at least partly sort of think about, you know, their past as an imperialist force, if they manage to address, you know, a lot of the issues in their own society. Because sadly, you know, it's not a question of just, you know, a bad, bloodthirsty president being in charge. Sadly, it's a lot of this has to do with, you know, Russian chauvinism, which has been unaddressed for way too long. And, you know, the Soviet Union never answered for its crimes against, you know, its own people. And a lot of these very traumatic pages from, you know, Russia's history books, they haven't been addressed. They haven't been talked about. And unless Russian society as a whole sort of, you know, starts talking about, you know, how did Russia manage to get so big? Did they, you know, might have they colonized someone? You know, why, you know, why are people from Central Asia being, you know, discriminated against? Why are, you know, a lot of Russian officials still using, you know, the word Slavic as a sort of code word for white? You know, unless they address these sort of racial, ethnic, and, you know, other issues in their own society, unless they, you know, they manage to face all of these problems, then I think, you know, a lot of Ukrainians, the majority of Ukrainians, definitely won't want to have anything to do with them. Because, you know, in order for Russia to, you know, to be a normal, I don't know, I hate using the word normal, but still, I just can't come up with a better descriptor here, you know, unless they want to be a normal society, they have to deal with all the hurt and, you know, the death and destruction they have caused throughout their history. And, you know, for that to change, obviously, we're going to see, you know, some real shifts in Russia. and some serious conversations about, you know, the issues they have. If they manage to go through that, then, you know, that's great, and I'll be happy for them. If they don't, then, you know, the only way for, you know, for the world to avoid an awful, you know, sort of situation like the one we're going through right now is for Russia to, you know, just not have enough resources to invade anyone ever again. Because, you know, either they realize why invading people is bad, or they just shouldn't have the means to do it. You know.
We are going to leave it there. Oleksandra Pavorochnik, thank you so much for joining us. And we will be back, as always. You can find the next scheduled episode of Live from Ukraine whenever one is scheduled. It is pinned to the top of my Twitter feed. I schedule them pretty impulsively when I persuade somebody to do one. So just keep an eye on the Twitter feed and on Lawfare's Twitter feed, and you'll always know which ones are coming up. You can find all the back episodes in the podcast feed, which you should subscribe to, share, and rate as per all the usual reasons. And we will be back next time. Thank you so much.
Live from Ukraine is a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. You know, the engineering, I'm doing it myself because it's Twitter Spaces, but it is produced and edited by folks at Goat Rodeo. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.